Session number 9963.
Mr. Brewer, reel two.
Then Sir Arthur put a few points and he said, well, now, what will you do? So I said, well, I will go back to South Wales. And then he gave the impression of blowing his top and proceeded to give a 5-minute exposition of the fact that South Wales was finished, that there was nothing there, there was no industry, no this, no that. And he concluded by saying, why go back? And by this time I was so damned angry, I could feel the hackles rising on the back of my neck. And I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody as contemptuously as I spoke to him. And I just gave him one sentence. I said, it's my country and my people. And shut up like a clam. And the consequence was, of course, that I didn't get the scholarship. I was a runner-up. But fortunately for me now, a chap more diplomatic than I had gone in for another scholarship somewhere else and given the right answers and got it. So then my second year was assured. Now, at the time, there were a number of refugees from Hitlerism coming to Britain.
This year would have been which?
This would be 1934. I was there from 34 to 36. And in our first year, we had three Germans. One was a trade union official, an extremely able chap, who had got out by the skin of his teeth. A chap called Werner Burmeister. And there was a Fraulein Schultz, who was a German Jewess, and another young woman whose mother had got out and brought her with her, Erika Eck, I think she was called. So we got information from the inside, as it were, apart from what we heard on the newspapers and in political speeches and so on, talking to these people. So we were fully aware. And of course we were going to the Oxford Union. We were in the Oxford University Labour Club. There were always great discussions going on. So I had this background of history and these classes on international relations and fairly detailed knowledge of the Treaty of Versailles, which, as Lloyd George pointed out, was the had sown the seeds of the next war. And this tutor of ours was very conscious of it. Then, of course, there was the additional fact that Moseley was going to bring his black shirts down to Bryn Mawr, I think it was. And there were a number of us, notably some of the lads from a nearby quarry town, Trevill, at the top of Tredegar. Hefty rugby players, strong as oxen. And we were members of the Divisional Labour Party. We were discussing all these things, and one of them had been in Moseley's demonstration and Moseley's meeting in the City Hall in Oxford, where he'd seen people being thrown down, bludgeoned and thrown down the stone steps and so on. And we said, well, we're not having that here. And if they come, we're going to go to the meetings and we're going to heckle. And if they try any rough stuff, then there'll be enough strong men in the audience to run them out of town, in spite of the policemen who'd be present. Well, up in Oxford then, we supported every anti-fascist idea that we could. And to our amazement now, Frau Schultz decided that Hitler was going to do something for Germany, and it was her country and she was going back. And the whole damn college, every student tried to dissuade her. that she, you know, she wouldn't have a stand a ghost of a chance being Jewish. But there you are, she had this intellectual idea, and she was German to the core, and she went back and probably ended up in one of the gas chambers.
Did you come across any support for Mosley at Oxford University?
No. I'm not, it wasn't, we never, well, we never went to the Conservative Club. And that one meeting, I think, had put pay to it. They obviously, there were Nazi sympathisers there, and anti-Labour people, anti-trade union people, and so on. But they, I don't know, they were rather quiet. They didn't seem to make any impression on the rest of the student body.
What about Mosleyite activity in this part of Wales? Was there any support for Mosley here?
Well, he never came to Bryn Mawr. He did go into the Rhondda, or at least his party did. There were a few there, but God, they were... I think they got more than they bargained for in the Rhondda.
In what way?
Oh, well, they finished their... polished their meetings off. They got in among them, and they got better than they gave. And the thing... they died. It had no support in the Rhondda.
Was there any anti-Jewish feeling in this part?
Oh, no. There were very few... Jews among us, but they had fitted into the community. They conformed to our way of life, more or less.
What were relations like in this area at that time between the Labour Party supporters like yourself and the local communists?
Well, in the Ebervale constituency, you must remember now, our Member of Parliament was an Irene Bevan. And there were a few communists, but they made no impression at all, because they hadn't then taken over the South Wales Miners Federation. And I think that their members were mostly people who couldn't get on with others, who thought they knew everything, and there wasn't that polarity, mind, between the communists and the socialists, because they didn't stand a chance of converting the majority of the people, and people are too wise to fall for extreme positions.
Were you influenced yourself at all by Marxism?
Well, I read the Communist Manifesto and I left it at that.
What did you think to the Communist Manifesto?
Well, it is a bit too far-fetched. I mean, we had practical objectives to secure, to get a Labour government, and to get to take control of local government, which affected us very greatly. And so it was, and of course, now one thing about Oxford was that you were, there was a lot of concentration on the English Civil War, Cromwell, the Stuarts and so on. And all the issues were there, really, in that. And our hero was Oliver Cromwell. We had no time for the Stuarts. And for example, now the Independents were quite an influential force in the Commonwealth Parliament. So pragmatically, we knew that the only way we could do anything was through Parliament. And extra parliamentary methods just didn't appeal to us at all.
What about the levellers and the diggers in the Civil War period? Weren't they your heroes?
We did think. Well, so before I went to Oxford, my reading of that period wasn't as deep as it should have been. It's only when I went there that I got into all this. And of course, I suppose you could say they were the communists of their day. And Oliver, of course, was a very conservative bloke in many respects. And but we knew that there was something there that we had to bring about again.
Did you come across communists at Oxford?
Oh yes, what's his name was one of the big lights in the Labour, Oxford University Labour Club was Philip Toynbee and his satellites.
What was he like as a person?
Well, I didn't think much of him myself because he always had this coterie of young people with him. I knew one or two. I was friendly with one or two of them. But I think he was unfortunate in that he was the son of a famous man. And he had quite a personality and so on. But there were greater minds there.
What was this about him that you didn't particularly like?
Well, first of all, the way he always had this crowd of girls around him, which struck me as rather unmanly. And he had this air about him that, you know, he was a person of consequence. Now, there was another chap there whom I met, the son of Dr. Tom Jones, who was the cabinet secretary. And his father was a Rumney boy. And, of course, he got on very well. He became professor of moral philosophy at one of the Scots universities. And Lloyd George brought him out of that into the Edward VII Tuberculosis Memorial Fund, where he did splendid work, very successful work. And then, of course, he went in as cabinet secretary. Now, Tristan was a very quiet chap. I never heard him talk or anything, but he had a tremendous capacity for organisation and so on. And but then he never made much of it after he left Oxford.
Was he a communist?
He might well have been, but I wouldn't like to say that he was. Because he was, he didn't do a lot of talking. He might have argued in some particular crowd, but they were there, you see, and they were a group on their own.
Who were?
The communists. Some were overt and some were covert, and you never sort of knew. But a lot of people failed to make. They didn't realise, and it took us some time to realise, a lot of us, that there was what they were about was antithetical to what the Labour Party was about.
In what way?
Well, that they wanted to seize power, and they wouldn't want any opposition, and they were inclined to take the words from on high, without arguing about it or. Going into it in any depth, and they certainly didn't impress me while I was there. But there were some outstanding scholars there and thinkers. One of whom impressed me very much was David Lewis, a Canadian. He was a Rhodes scholar, and whenever he spoke, you got a great deal of sense out of what he said. And he went back to Canada and he founded the Canadian equivalent of the British Labour Party. And it was a hell of a struggle. And he died about 2 years ago, but it had become a recognised party. This American professor who came here was telling me that David Lewis had a very impressive record in Canadian politics.
Did you consider yourself at that time to be a revolutionary socialist?
Only to the degree that that I firmly believed in parliamentary democracy. And I didn't want to see people going about breaking other people's heads and killing them and so on. And the proper road to power was through Parliament, which would have to have the support of the majority of the people. And I couldn't see the streets running with blood and so on in Britain. So I suppose I was what the Labour Party proposed was revolutionary enough. It would sort of redress the balance as far as the working people were concerned.
So when you were at Oxford, when Franco staged his attempted coup in Spain...
Which one now?
The coup which started off the Spanish Civil War in July 1936.
No, no. I was... the one thing that, again, that made a where Spain was concerned, that made a tremendous impression on us as miners, was Franco's putting down of the Asturian miners. And that really, really went to the quick. And I think it influenced us, because once you've been a miner, you've got a different attitude to life from other people who have never been in the mines. And we thought that was damned horrible. And of course the miners sent as much money as they could spare to help to relieve the distress in the Asturias. But when the war broke out in Spain, I'd finished at Ruskin, and one of my friends, who was a seaman, he'd been educated at Pangbourne, and he had his he'd come to Ruskin for a year, and he had his first mate's papers in sail and steam. And he said, "Now, how about?" He said, "You're fairly tough. You can handle yourself. How about coming on around Cape Horn trip on the Windjammer?" And I said, "Well, no, there's only one thing stopping that, Dick." I said, "I'd have to pay £50 for the privilege of being, now I don't know what they called them, what one would be called, I've forgotten the name now, but you paid £50 and you became a member of the crew, and you were under captain's orders, and you set about learning your duties as a seaman." And he had sent me a telegram to say, from New York, to say that you'd be in Oxford on a certain day, and he'd look to meet me at Carfax at a certain hour. So I duly went along, and we went and had lunch. And he was saying that this Finnish windjammer, the Herzogin Cecilia, had gone ashore down off Start Point in Devon, and he was going down to join the salvage crew. And he said, "Well, if you're doing nothing this summer, now why not come down, and we'll and you should be able to, they would waive the £50 indenture, and you'll be able to come along." So I was in, there was a camp in Wallingford then, run by the universities to provide holidays for the unemployed workers in distressed areas. And there were a lot of student volunteers there, socialist, liberal, and communist. and there were communists from the East End down there, and these people were coming for a fortnight's holiday, camp holiday at Wallingford. So I got in touch with Dick Southern though, and said that I would be finishing in this camp on a certain day, and that I'd come down to do a bit of work on this sailing ship. And one of the girls in the camp, I didn't know what her background was. She was middle class, at least I thought, and we were quite good friends. And I mentioned now that I was going to cycle down to Salcombe. Oh, she said, don't do that. My home is nearby in Dorset. You come down, dismantle your bike, put it in the boot of the car, and I'll drive you down. You come and stay at our place for the night, and then you can cycle on the next day. And in all innocence now, I said, certainly. That's very nice of you. And off we went. And we got to this place, damn, I've forgotten it now, but anyway, she said, now we turn off here up to my home. So we went through these gates and up this damn drive, and there was a palatial mansion. And I said, Catherine, you've been pulling my leg. Now, I said, what am I doing in a place like this? I said, now look, the sensible thing to do now was to turn back and drop my bike off, and I'll take my rucksack and carry on to Salcombe. No, she insisted on my going in. She said, my parents will be pleased to see you, and so on. Well, all I had with me was the then equivalent of a T-shirt, a couple of pairs of trousers, and a pullover. And I went... she persuaded me anyway to come along, and she said, oh, you're a coward. And that got my back up. And first thing now, we drove up to the front, and out comes a valet who took my bike out, my rucksack, and she asked him then if he'd get the chauffeur to fix the bike up for me. And in we went. Met her parents. Now, he was a Dorset coal owner. I think there was a mine somewhere nearby that he owned, and he was an aristocrat, so was his wife. Well, I was really shocked that she'd got me into that, but I thought, well, hell's bells, I'm as good as they are, and I think I've got manners adequate to the occasion. So I met her father then, had a bath, changed my shirt, and went down. And he had refrained from putting his evening suit on. He was in casuals, and we got to talking. And the civil war in Spain had just broke out. I think it had started. But anyway, I was persona grata with him because he had commanded a Welsh battery or something in the First World War, and the Welsh miners. But oh, he was very upset over King Alfonso's departure from Spain, poor Alfonso, and so on. And I wondered about this business, whether the Republican government would be able to put down this attempted coup. Well, then I went down to... next day, I went off to Salcombe now, went aboard this ship, and I'd been there about a fortnight, and Chris Thornycroft, whom I'd met in this camp, and we'd become quite good friends. He turned up one day in Salcombe and came aboard, got a rowing boat and came out, because they were encouraging visitors to come, to put some money in the box to pay for salvage. So we arranged then with Chris that we'd go out the following day. We had a day off, and we'd take the boat and some lines, and we'd go out fishing for mackerel in the channel. Well, we caught a few fish, but the discussion then was on what was happening in Spain. And I put forward the view that what was happening was so disgusting, and the attitude of the League of Nations was so appalling, that I said that anyone who called himself a socialist and was footloose and fancy free would go to the aid of the Republic if they would have them. But I said that the young men now all over Europe and in America who are considering all this, and with the background of knowledge we've got, there are big things afoot. So we argued the toss all morning and afternoon. And then we took Chris back to Salcombe, and we parted on the quay, and he said, well, the next time I'll see you now, Jim, will be in Spain. Well, I said, yes, if I can get there, and if we were welcome. And damn me if on our way up to the Jarama front, we stopped. We were off a train at Aranjuez, I think, and we were waiting for lorries to come and take us and our guns up to the front. And I saw some ambulances nearby, and clearly they were part of the British ambulance effort. So I walked across to these now, and as I went along, there was a girl coming towards me, and she had better eyesight than me, and she'd recognised me. And I knew her quite well at Oxford, and she was delighted to see me. And I said, well, now then, if you were here, I said, Chris Sornikoff is bound to be here, because we are part of a circle of friends. And she said, yes, he's over there. He's driving one of the ambulances.
What was her name?
Name I can't remember. It's amazing. It was completely blotted out. And I never met her afterwards. But I walked across the ambulance, and there was Chris, been working on the engine. And I said, well, here I am. He said, I've been expecting to see you. He said, I thought you'd get here. And then that was the last time I met Chris until one of our big reunions up in London. The first one I went to, we had quite a big gathering. And of course, we've been good friends ever since. But it was strange that that we were able to see that